This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
I never did anything that got me properly suspended. You can either go the way you're going and rebel and get a bunch of C's, or you can figure out that also being an entrepreneur is rebellious. Essentially, you can have whatever you want in life as long as you earn it.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. On this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Lauren Scott Harris. Lauren is the founder of Earned, and we'll talk a lot about that during this podcast. But she started out in communications and marketing, working for dynamic startups, including Headspace and One Fine Stay, before she had her idea for Earned and has made it quite a success. So I'm really keen to talk to her about her background, her move into communications and startups, and the idea behind founding Earned. Lauren, it's really nice to have you on the podcast, and I'm very excited about hearing your story. But before we get on to all of that, I just want to pry a little and find out if there was anything in your early days that led you to want to move into a career, first of all, in communications, and then as the founder of a digital platform.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's so great to be on. And I'm actually, you might be able to hear that I'm smiling as I'm thinking about school days, because my school experience was a coin of two sides. On one hand, I was quite studious. At some point, under some brilliant tutelage, decided to pay attention. And I definitely could have gone two ways, because the other side was I was really naughty, like really naughty. And I never did anything that got me properly suspended, but I stepped up to the mark a number of times, to the dismay of both parents and teachers. But I do remember there was one particularly amazing teacher who was teaching me A-level history. And she just wasn't having it. She just said, all these antics are just boring. They're not impressing me at all. You're actually really good at history, but I think you'd be even better at politics because you're really argumentative, which I took as a compliment, and then really honed in on the politics. She was absolutely right. I think probably the common thread of everything I really enjoyed studying at school was systems, people's behavior, psychology, sociology, what makes us human, what makes us happy as humans, and how can we do all that better?
That's a bit of a voyage of discovery, isn't it? So you must have been somewhere between 16 and 18. And so when the teacher said that to you, did it make you knuckle down? Did you think, oh, actually, I should apply myself?
Yes, because she put it in a way which really, really spoke to me, which I think she said something along the lines of, you know, you can either go the way you're going and rebel and get a bunch of C's and whatever, or you can figure out pretty quickly that also being an entrepreneur is rebellious. Like, that's the far more interesting route. So would you not prefer to ace all your A-levels, get to exactly the university you want to go, and then you can go and be disruptive, but be disruptive in a way that's going to make you money and do something for the world, rather than, you know, messing around here and turning up for my lesson late.
And then was there anything in your school days that sort of prepared you or made you think that what you've done in your business life would happen? Did you write in the school magazine, or did you set things up, or did you play team sports? Was there anything there that was a sort of a guide to what you might do?
I think I figured out too late that I would have quite liked to be a prefect, but by that stage I had been pretty naughty, as I say. I think it was much more on the family side. So my father was an entrepreneur. He had a brilliant ad agency and some other businesses. I think, kind of without being explicit, we were sort of, you know, we were taught, like, essentially, you can have whatever you want in life as long as you earn it. No one's going to give it to you. So if you want to drive a big fancy car, great, you're going to have to make a lot of money. And that was, I think, the lesson that we were all imbued with, which was freedom being part of, you know, going out there and working really hard, because that was what was on the other side. So it was definitely, I think it was a combination of really, really good teachers at school that got me on the straight and narrow, put together with everything that I was learning at home from my parents.
And so just thinking about that for a moment, when you do look back to those days, then you think about what you learned from your parents, what lessons do you think have been most important to your working life?
I think definitely a sense of fairness and earning it and meritocracy. I mean, I really, really thought, probably a little naively, that everything was a meritocracy based on democracy and capitalism being systems, which I believed were entirely fair. I'm not sure I believe that anymore. But I have all these memories. Like, there's a particular one of, you know, we have a really fortunate upbringing, but we'd go skiing, and we, you know, we had days where we take lifts and we go down and have lunch in a restaurant. But there would be days when we'd go off with my dad or a guide or something, and we would walk and walk and walk and walk and end up just doing one run. But they were teaching us, my father and anyone who was came, was always about taking the joy on the way up, taking it slow, enjoying the mountains. And then we'd always get down and everything would be closed. And we'd have, our tradition was we'd have a bottle of beer and a tartare, because that was always defined at sort of 4:30 in the afternoon. But those lunches tasted better than the other lunches. You look forward to it like you wouldn't, like the first taste of both of those things just brings total joy to my mind. And I think that was the beginning of this big lesson of how wonderful that feeling is when you truly feel that you've merited or earned something.
So with that in your mind, you started to work very hard on your A-levels. And what happened there? Where did you decide to go to study, and what did you study?
So then I went to Bristol and I read politics and sociology, but I ended up dropping the sociology. I was more interested in the politics. I liked the professors a bit more. And I got really specific. I think I did my dissertation on the most niche subject possible, which was the Ethiopian constitution. I'm not entirely sure in retrospect what led me there, other than I was very interested in African politics. But yeah, that was 3 years of really looking at, again, kind of the psychology behind politics and why people behave differently in all these different countries around the world. And I just found it fascinating. I could have probably enjoyed psychology, social anthropology, or anything, you know, within that vein. But for me, it was kind of the politics that really got me excited.
You left university. Let's talk about your first job, and then take the chronology through to you starting your own businesses.
It's a fun story, actually. I went straight from university to work experience at a place called Freud Communications, which was thrilling because it was kind of the university of communications. I wanted to be in media. My dad was in advertising. I didn't want to go into that. I got an introduction to Freud, just an email to send, and they said, come in for some work experience. And then I just had this very, very inspiring, brilliant boss called Laura Weston, who said, if you can hang out for about 3 months, there will be a job for you at the end. You just got to wait until that position comes up. And that was it. And then I didn't leave Freud until, I think about 3 years later, there was one spot in the New York office. And of course, 65 people said, I'll take it, thanks. And I don't know how, but I managed. And there was a bit of pest of power, and then there was sheer determination. And I managed to get the spot. And I moved over to New York, and I was, it was just such perfect timing. I'd learned all of my beginning lessons in PR on FMCGs. So I'd been working on Pizza Hut and Lynx deodorant, and none of which were particularly glamorous. But then when I moved over to New York, the dollar was 2 to 1 to the pound. So my salary doubled. I could walk to the office. I could suddenly join a gym and take taxis rather than, you know, walking and taking bus all the time. And then I got put on accounts like Soho House and some more hospitality, which was just brilliant. I don't think there was a quicker way in New York at the time to make friends other than to know how to get people into Soho House as it was opening. And I don't think I know any of those same people now, but definitely for a moment I became quite popular. And from there, I was really fortunate. Again, I had a lovely boss who, when he saw that I was getting burnt out, and I handed him my notice, I said, I've been in New York for four and a half years now. And you're really in New York when you're in New York. You get 21 days holiday. You get nothing between Christmas and New Year's. You can kind of go home once a year and you do all your 10 days at once. And other than that, you're in this tiny city. It's 9 miles by 3 miles. So I was really exhausted. And I said, look, I think I'm going to go to live in Kenya for a bit, because I just have never taken any time, and I'm feeling the need for countryside and big open spaces, the sort of opposite of New York. And he very sweetly said, "We'll have a sabbatical, take 3 months, and then I'd love you to come back afterwards." And I went down to Kenya, and I had a friend in Kenya who's sadly no longer with us, but he had a safari camp, and he had a lot of other friends with safari camps. And he said, "Why don't we do a swap? We will house you. You get bed and board. Board will sometimes be in the back of the Land Rover. Board could be in a room if we have one available. But you do the PR from here, out in the bush, and we'll tell you where there's signal, and you have to run up to the top of a hill to send your emails. And we'll just feed you and make sure that you don't get lost or eaten by lions." And that went on for the whole time, and I was bouncing all over and going between camps. And I think I was about 26 at the time. And then at the end of that time, they said, "Well, we'd love to work with you still. This is really working, but we're not going to hire an agency in New York. It's way too expensive. So if you go back to that job, that's not, thank you, but goodbye." And I said, "No, I'm going back to the job." And then the moment I got to New York, knew that I wanted to make the other decision, I called and I said, "Look, okay, you'll be the first client." They said, "Yep, there'll be 10 of us, and we'll club together and be your first client. And we'll help you get some in Tanzania because we've got lots of friends down there." And it took about 3 months. I knew I needed three clients to get started. And I think, yeah, it took about 3 months of me sitting and crossing fingers and trying to email everyone in Kenya. There was only so many times you could chase people. But then suddenly it came together. And at that time, I named the company Scott Ideas. I just love the word ideas. And I was one of very few companies in New York that, or people in New York, I suppose, that knew the British market and the American market. And the other, only other choices than me were a big agency. So there was this really lovely niche in the market whereby they weren't paying enormous amounts, but they could pay me and I could do British press and American press. And as a result, I managed to connect with some really brilliant startups, One Fine Stay being one of them, Headspace at the very beginning of their journey when there were two, it was just the two of them, and they were sitting in a small cupboard office in Charlotte Street. And then a great travel company called Black Tomato. And from there, it just kind of rolled. And then you need one employee, and then suddenly you've got six, and then suddenly it's 10. And yeah, that was started in 2010 and is still going today, but it's now called the Re-Agency.
So before I talk to you about building that and what it was like and being on your own, then getting a team and then moving out and doing your other things, just talk to us a little about PR, because there are people listening to this will think PR is very glamorous. They may have watched Ad Fab, and they will have a perception of what it's like. So what's it really like? What do you do in PR? What's the job? What do you spend your time doing? What does success look like?
PR is now one of the many channels that brands can employ to advance their spot in the market and remind people they're there and get them to purchase their products. It used to be much more, used to have to be far better at writing. I think now people are, of course, across the board using things like ChatGPT, so you can write a lot quicker. But what I found, I think my USP was, and what we were good at as an agency, therefore, was finding really interesting juxtapositions and creative pitches. Journalists are being sent news releases all the time, they're being sent ideas all the time. But when you really, really understand a client and you really understand the points that a journalist is interested in, you can come up with some really cool story ideas that mean that instead of going, "Yep, we'll run a little paragraph on it," people go, "Yeah, that's a feature, that's a really good idea." When I first met Headspace, I had a lot to learn about meditation. Andy, one of the founders, was a former Buddhist monk, and that was all really, really, really interesting. But about 6 months in, he mentioned to someone else, and I overheard, that he'd gone to circus school for 3 weeks. I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, I was really terrified of public speaking, so I went to circus school, and for 3 weeks, you have to make people laugh, and you're doing all of these, you stand on stage, and you're meant to be a clown, and people are just standing there with their arms crossed." And he said the self-confidence, grew in him was massive. So the moment you hear something like that, you think, "God, that's unusual." That's a new pitch to a journalist, a totally different angle. Circus clown, monk turned circus clown turned tech entrepreneur, and then they go, "Now that is an interesting story." So always looking for little nuances, unusual little things that people, that will catch people's eye, and putting a story in a different page. So I think another thing that we really focused on was, whatever the client was, we would try and move them away from the pages that you'd expect to see them in. So a new hotel in Condé Nast Traveler is great, but actually a new hotel in the New York Times. It's something like, you know, it's a much harder section to get into, but you're going to remember the name of that hotel. You're going to read the article. You might read Condé Nast Traveler and get to the end and think you just want to go to an airport, but you might not remember, you know, the 20 lovely hotels you've written about. So it was always finding interesting spots to place things. And, you know, if it was a finance client, trying to move them out of the FT during the week. And even if it was just into the weekend, you know, lunch with the FT or something, then it was getting more standout.
And why do you think you were good at it? What makes somebody good at being a PR?
Well, I think a bit of dyslexia makes you good at being PR. I think it's creative thinking. And I think there's so much now that you can use. I mean, no one knows I'm dyslexic because I use Grammarly and I use, you know, a bunch of other things to make sure that there aren't 100 typos. That wasn't possible at the beginning of my career. So it was a bit trickier then to mask it or to try and get around it. But I do think your brain makes different connections. And that's actually how Earned was formed as well. I think you can see the world slightly differently and put things together that everybody else hasn't quite done yet. But in PR, you're going to want to be pretty organized, despite the AbFab element. And you're going to want to really, really, really take the time to get to know a client. And that requires quite a lot of emotional intelligence. There's one thing which is getting to know the client's product, and you better know that inside out. I mean, there is nothing worse than seeing a meeting go down where someone hasn't quite done enough studying on their side. Total disaster. And that would be the main complaint we'd get from clients when they'd come to us from another agency and they go, they just didn't put in the, you know, didn't take the time to get to know us. The other thing, which I found to be very useful and occasionally probably caused for more anxiety than I would like, but when you get to know a client personally and you're able to pick up on tiny signs that they might not be as happy as you'd like them to be, you can fix it faster. And I've worked with people who are really emotionally intelligent, and I've worked with people that have a little bit less of that quality. And those people sometimes walk out of a meeting and go, great, it's all signed off. And you go, do you know what? She's not happy. This, and then you put in a follow-up call and you go, listen, I can tell you were a bit tense during that meeting. What was it? Because the client hasn't said, you know, it's very rare actually that a client's going to go, right, let's be clear, I don't like this, this, and this. Sometimes they're ruminating on it. Sometimes it's something that you don't know about. There might be budget trouble in the company. They might be about to let someone go, you know, it's something that's troubling them. But if you can have a really close relationship with it, you can keep navigating those as small bumps rather than going into a wall. And I think that's the thing that's quite difficult to train as well, in people.
So, in summary, you would say that having empathy, being able to read people, understand people, and adjust, being creative, thinking of new ideas, new ways, that those are key attributes that you'd want to see in somebody working in the PR industry.
Absolutely.
So, let's go back to founding Scott Ideas. So, you've flown back to New York. You think, I'm not going to go back to Freud. It's far too exciting to set up my own business. And you'd got three customers at the time. So you thought, these are going to pay me enough to cover my food and board. But take us from there. What did you do about cash flow, invoicing, office space, hiring your first person? How was that part of the journey for you?
Well, that is when it got trickier. The cash flow, the immediate cash flow was fine because it was enough to cover a salary that I felt excited about. And there aren't that many hard costs, really. You know, I needed all the emails of the journalists that I knew anyway, which I had. I needed a Wi-Fi connection, and I ideally needed an office, but you can often do meetings in a, you know, in a corner shop where you can do it at the client's office. It doesn't really matter too much. So at the beginning, I really didn't have too many overheads. I also had a very kind Australian friend who had a huge agency with lots of space in it. And he said, look, you can just squat in the corner for a bit. And he had a digital agency. And oh yeah, and then one day his colleague came over and said, this corner doesn't look particularly impressive. You know, when you're doing calls, he said, let's design your logo and literally just scribbled something down and I loved it. So then we made that into a neon sign. And I think that was my very first cost. And then the hiring didn't actually happen until I moved back to London. So I moved back to London a couple of years later and then it was really, really time because it was just the inquiries that were coming in were too exciting. And I think again, yeah, first office, I was in a friend's office on the Strand, not paying any rent. Second office managed to pay a little rent because there were three of us by then, you know, and then we grew incrementally and incrementally. And now we've got a lovely office in Soho, which truly took about 2 years to find. It was one of the trickier and more time consuming exercises. But yeah, then it was sort of, there was a lot of working things out on the go. And what I really had no appreciation of was I was truly just going, sort of following my gut on it. So if I knew that we had a bit more money, or if we had another client coming in, that we could get another employee. Now, on a business that will not exist on working capital for a while because of all the tech spend up front, you suddenly realize what a simple journey it is to be able to just, go forth on working capital, not have any investors, follow your nose a bit, not have too many overheads. But I mean, there were so many major cracks I nearly stepped on. I mean, thank God, every now and then my dad would say, remember to do corporation tax? And I'd go, Lauren, are you doing PAYE? Yes. there were a few things at the beginning that really, really, really were learned on the run. But this
Those people listening, what is it about those early years that helped you to get through, to have the resilience to learn all those new things and make the business successful? What do you need to be good at that?
I think you need to be quite stubborn. I really thought that I just wanted to be self-employed. There wasn't actually at the beginning a grand aspiration of having a big agency. It was just that I wanted to be my own boss, and I wanted to take on the clients I wanted to take on. And also, a lot of the clients I really liked could only pay a certain amount. So I wouldn't have been able to work with Headspace or all these wonderful safari camps while, if that was going into a big major agency. So I think being quite stubborn. I was very anxious at that time as well. I really there were times when maybe a client didn't pay or something, and it wouldn't be more than, I was very bad at wearing both hats. So I wanted to be I was very good at client servicing, but when it came time to chasing invoices, I was really polite about it. And would you mind terribly? And it was sort of 6 months in arrears, and that's an enormous amount of money for a company to stomach. But I was sort of just about making it through. And then we had a few bad payers. And at that point, actually, after a few years, I went to my father and I said, I think I need some help here. This guy's just defaulted on, I think someone owed about 40 grand that never came through. But for, at the age of 29, that's enormous. And you get this sort of curt letter saying they've gone into administration, that your invoices won't be paid. And then you suddenly see the company pop up again a year later, with a slightly different name. And it happened maybe twice, and that was really infuriating. And that's when you really got to dig deep and duck and weave. And I think there was maybe one time I had to turn my salary off for a few months directly as a result of that one. But I just always wanted to do it. I just every few months we get a client inquiry, and I think we just have to work with them. This sounds amazing, and because we're really broad, I got to learn about so many different industries. We'd take on some hotels, and that would be great fun. We'd go and see them be built and designed and understand kind of the business model there a bit. And then at one point, we had a fantastic VC client, and I knew very little about VC, but I learned it really quickly. And I'd sit and listen to them in meetings and learn from osmosis. And so I just felt like I was getting a sort of little masterclass from all these brilliant captains of their various industries. And my thirst for that knowledge was just never ending. So I think curiosity is good.
And before I start to ask you about Earned and the idea you had for that 12 years ago and then setting it up, just talk a little about the agency today.
Well, the agency today is run by a brilliant colleague of mine called Emma Harding. So she's also a shareholder, and she became CEO probably in 2020 as we were going into COVID, because I knew at that point that I needed to do Earned, and I knew that I probably couldn't do both at once. So at that point, after COVID, we called it the re-agency, because everything that we knew was having to be rethought, and we were talking to clients about rethinking their attitude to whatever, people working from home, reconsidering their impact on society, on the environment, all of these things. So it was all this kind of big rethink. And it has offices in London and New York. And we had a really tough time during COVID because we had a lot of big travel clients. So we had to do a massive rebuild after that, because despite best intentions, very few of them could come back as quickly as they wanted. And then it was a totally different level of retainer. So it really took a while to get back there. But because we're quite reflective of the economy, we had quite broad interests. We then, after that, suddenly got a lot of interior design clients because at that point, that industry was thriving. You know, everyone was redecorating their homes during COVID. So now it's a really big mix. It's got a lot more travel in these days. We've got quite a lot of interior design. We've got some really interesting entrepreneurs that we represent. And it's a really, really nice makeup. I think everybody, this sounds a little flippant, but we always had a rule that if we sat all the clients together around the table, that there would be a sort of shared sense of everybody having a sense of purpose, or at least they would all get on. And that has led to this kind of collection of really wonderful clients from all over the world, from ranch safaris in Wyoming through to all the interiors clients that we have, through to lots of great travel properties. So it's quite a big smorgasbord.
Great. So the next step of your journey is a really interesting one, because as if that wasn't enough for anybody, you decided that you were going to set up a digital platform called Earned. And what I'd like you to do now is just tell our listeners about how you had the idea, what the idea is, and then how you've developed it.
But the idea for Earned came about, I think there were a few different inputs in my dyslexic brain that kind of led to the output of Earned. One, while I was at Freud London, there was Bono's Red campaign began, which I thought was a really interesting thing about linking profit and purpose. I think that really, really suddenly just made me think slightly differently about the world. And then I'd had this idea. I literally wrote it down about 12 years ago, which was I'm very impatient. And so seeing people standing outside of Nike Town or Apple or something like queuing for products, I just thought, what an enormous waste of time. And there's just nothing I could think of that would make me stand outside in the cold in order to get a product. But then I thought, if these people really want that, maybe you could give them something useful to do, right? What about a limited edition trainer in a particular colorway? The only way that you can get it is if you come and do 6 hours of tree planting. And we host big tree planting events, and everybody comes and do it, and all that energy that's kind of being wasted standing outside of a shop is given back to society. I thought that's interesting. I thought that people are having a bit of an experience, we're learning something, the brand is still selling them to you. This is just the access. So I just literally thought about it as some kind of scientific equation whereby energy was being wasted and could you redirect it? And anyway, that sat at the back of my mind for ages and ages and ages, but I never put it down. And it was during it, I think it was leading up to COVID, I was really beginning to investigate it. And then during COVID, I remember this really, really poignant moment whereby influencer culture had erupted. And we were getting hammered, frankly, with requests from influencers all day long about what hotel they wanted to stay at, what product they want sent to them. You know, it was a lot of me, 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 I want this, 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 this. And simultaneously opening the papers and seeing that as a society, we were allowing nurses and teachers to go to food banks. I was sitting there thinking, like, the two biggest fears I have right now are that one of my parents is hospitalized, and the only people you think about in that scenario are the nurses and the doctors looking after them. They are heroes. And then I had a 3-year-old son who, they were still letting children go to nursery, and he was a nursery school age. And these heroes that were looking after him all day so that I was able to do my job and try and do this thing. And I thought, why? These people are unbelievably important and wonderful. And yet brands are sitting here, and every time we get a request, I want another handbag, or I want this, they're sort of rolling over and clapping their hands and going, yeah, she's got loads of followers, send her another present. And I just thought, this is just nauseating. And I got really angry about it and started sketching out to see how you could just essentially use brands to encourage and reward good behavior. So what if Glastonbury said, look, we'll release 100 tickets early because we know you will sit for hours with your laptops open and everything. But those can only be accessed by people that earn it. And to earn it, we're putting this price on it. We want everyone, those people, to do 20 hours in a homeless shelter or 20 hours in a food bank, whatever it is that the Evises feel is important to them. They get to pick their currency, as it were. And then I just, like, we just kept sitting there. It was myself, and actually, funnily enough, in a lovely turn of events, I was introduced to a man called Seb Bishop, who was running Red for Bono. And very early in the Red days, they were working from the Freud office. So unbeknown to me, I would have walked past him 100 times in the corridor, but as an intern, you know, probably not even looked up. And he was CEO of Red, and so there was just zero way that we'd be talking. But I was introduced to him and I said, oh my God, you run red, I've got to run this idea past you. And he said, I think it's golden. I think you've got to do it. But if you're doing it, do it. You're not going to be able to do two jobs at once. And thank you very much for the last five PowerPoints you've sent me, all of which are in north of 100 pages. Could you just get out there and do it? I mean, I wrote dissertations like you would not believe. I spent hours picking the nicest photos, none of which I will add had a business model. It was literally just the idea. And it was all this kind of, researching actually into the psychological benefits of volunteering and all the work I've done with Headspace, I think, on what does it take us as individuals to be happy? Why does meditation help us? Why does being in community help us? Why is it that, you could have a great relationship and you could have a great job and you could be a wonderful parent, but there is a piece of the human puzzle that is literally labeled community, and we all need it, regardless of whether we've got billions in the bank or whether we've got absolutely nothing. There's this part of us that is truly, truly, truly in need of it. And I think that was another thing that came from COVID. Suddenly, community was removed. We did not get to see people. Everything was so, so isolating. And it was just really, it was suddenly very stark. I suddenly realized that I knew there'd been an earthquake in Turkey and I wanted to donate, but I didn't actually know that the lady two doors down from me just lost her husband and was looking for a bit of a chat in the morning. And it just, I think it really, really shone this big light on it. And I just thought, well, yeah, we need it. We want it. Brands also need to be doing ESG and CSR and all these things. So how can we build this system? So we'd spoke to some brands early on. Everyone was interested. No one could quite understand how it worked. We just about worked out that we would charge the brands. We didn't want to be a charity. We didn't want to every year we'd go into these brands and going, can we have 5,000 pairs of shoes? Can we have these tickets? We didn't want that to happen. We wanted them to be benefiting from the system. So the first one we did, we went to my son's school, which is a little state school in Barnes called Barnes Primary, and it's just glorious. But we said, listen, do you have any problems that we can please take a crack at? And the headmistress said, sure, the playground's broken. It will cost quite a lot of money for us to fix it. I think it was 2,500 or 3,000 pounds. If we had that money, we wouldn't spend it there. We've got a lot of other things we need to spend money on. Could you take that on? So he said, yep, and we think we can fix it for £250. She said, knock yourself out. And then you have to forgive the fact that we chose these guys as a brand partner, but the pub is next to the school. So we went into the pub and we said, here's an idea. Can you guys spend £250 on silver tankards? We're going to put a poster up of this tankard. We'll tell anyone that they can have a free tankard in this pub and we'll engrave their name on it. But they have to, the only way to get it is to fix the playground. We're not selling them to anyone. You're not getting one if you're in here every night. This is it. And we put up a terrible poster. Oh, and the pub also sweetly said, they said, look, it's August. We'll give everyone a free pint if they have a tankard. The first, every time they use the tankard, it's the first pint on the house for the next month. So we put up a poster, went and sat in the playground, and 65 people came. And we were thrilled. And there were two or three that were there definitely against their will, who were teenagers who were sort of being dragged because they'd done something naughty the night before. But anyway, we set to building, like fixing this thing. And there are, of course, lots of people who have no idea and wanted to just go and do some painting. Fine, we had enough work for them too. We had the site manager there organizing everybody. We had some people that were really, really good with tools and some people that really needed a lot of direction. It didn't matter. We got it fixed. But what we then saw was that these 65 people had met one another for the first time. They were neighbors on neighboring streets, but they'd maybe seen one another in the pub. They'd not actually connected. So they're all talking, spending the day together. And then we see that all of these people are in the pub now a lot. And the pub said to us at the end of the month, they said, we estimate that all those people used our pub two or three times more than normal. We think we've made about another £2,000 in profit because no one comes in for just the free pint. They're coming in for the extras. We've heard all the people at the bar when other, people from outside come in and they go, oh, I'd like a tankard. And they go, no, you had to earn it. So it just created this incredible little micro community and everybody won. The volunteers had a great day and they made friends. The school got the playground fixed and the pub made more money. And we just thought, that's the golden triangle. This is how we're going to do it. And, it sounds so basic. Everybody knows you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. But it was really against the grain as to what everybody was telling us from marketing. Everyone was saying, no, customer wants ease of journey, click, click, buy, click, click, this, click, click, date. And actually, everyone's sick of that. Or my view on the world is if you want to ask me on a date, it better be more than, a double click that you've done. And if you want to send me a present. I'd rather it wasn't a double click on Amazon. You know, we've kind of removed the value from things by doing everything so fast. And a lot of people felt that way, we realized. It was really tapping into something. So now when we launch an event, they tend to get booked out in 2 minutes or so. From the pub, we decided to challenge ourselves a bit. We were lucky, it was an introduction, but we went to Ruthie Rogers. We met her and we said, look, here's an idea. Can we say there's a special earned section on your list and that they're VIPs? So if people come in to rent a reservation, they're on the VIP list, the full George Clooney treatment, because there's always a table for George Clooney. And she said, yeah, tell me more. And we said, well, we'll ask people to earn it by doing 4 hours of litter picking on the river. And she said, that's great, because we're looking at the river all day long and it's gross and we worry about it. And she said, but good luck, you know, that we don't know how this is going to go. And then we started telling people about it, and the feedback was generally, this is not a good idea, because people that spend £300 on lunch are probably not going to want to jump in the river because it's really unpleasant. And they had a point. But anyway, we then we sent the email out through the River Cafe database, invited people to participate, and 1,500 people tried to sign up. And we were giggling because we only had 30 spots, but we said to we said to Ruthie, what do you want to do? And she said, well, first of all, you've got to make 10 more spaces because we've got 10 regulars complaining that they can't get on it. We said, well, if they're regulars, they can always have a table. And she said, they want to come on it, so let them come on it. And then we sort of were giggling about the fact that, you know, the rubbish we were picking up was no nicer because it was River Cafe rubbish. We told them, you guys can go and do it whatever you want. But it was such a lovely draw, and it was so cool to see, you know, Ruthie clicks her fingers and she could have got that many people doing. I mean, imagine how much work that is. It's amazing. So coming to people with a constructive action under the lens of a brand or a person that they trust, getting them together, it's been so special. If we'd recorded the conversations that were going on during that first River Cafe Litterpick, there was a mum and a son who were trying to get a table for dad's birthday, and they'd never managed to get a table before. There was one of the regulars who ate there every day, and he said, I just want to make some friends. And then there was a guy who'd been asking a girl out on a date repeatedly, and she kept saying no, and he thought the River Cafe table would swing it. I don't know if it did. But it's just been, I think the first part, I didn't realise at the time, but it was a human experiment. Like, will people do it? Will brands pay us to put this together? And will the causes trust us that we're bringing the, you know, people that are going to do it, people that aren't trying to cheat the system? There's nothing worse than, you know, an intern who's more trouble than, you know, it's worse to not be doing it yourself. And we've just had the most incredible, incredible interactions with people, incredible responses. We did one with a coffee shop last year, which just filled my heart with glee. And we're actually going to do it this year too. It's called Haven Coffee, and they wanted a loyalty scheme. So we said, okay, we'll do the same sort of thing as we did with Barnes Primary. We'll find 6 schools that need 50 to 100 people to do a massive fix-up, painting, blah, 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 blah. And they said, okay, and what did they get? We said, design us a reusable coffee cup that says Earn Haven member on it, in a special colour. And then you can, when people use it, their coffee will be on the house. And we said, but here's the important thing. The person behind them gets their coffee on the house as well. So they said, well, that's silly because we're giving away double the amount of coffee. But of course, what happened is every time someone used the green cup, the person behind them said, hang on, why have you got me free coffee? And that person gets to say in front of everybody else, oh, I do this volunteering thing. It was so great. We went to this school. They feel like a hero. They've had a little interaction with someone. And we now see people in the shops engineering their spots. So if they see someone with a green cup, they go right behind. Or the holder of the green cup is standing deliberately in front of someone that's pretty attractive. And you think, this is awesome. Like, people flirting at 8 a.m. is just the best. So that has been really, really lovely. And when we put the cup on now, it literally goes in 2 minutes flat. Like, and we're constantly getting messages and people going, where's Hagen, where's Hagen?
So tell me, Lauren, I mean, it's a phenomenal idea, and you're doing great good, you know, for the communities, for individuals, for brands as well. So what's the future? Where do you see Earned in, say, 5 and 10 years time?
So this for me is going to be nothing short of global. And what we've done is create now. So we, as I say, we kind of did this human experiment and we realized it was working. But then we realized that we were really cutting people out by doing it as big group events in the you might be in Manchester and love the River Cafe, but there's no point in you coming down to London for a Saturday morning to clean the river and go back. So we thought, how do we scale it? And then we talked to lots of causes who, of course, said the same thing. They said, look, we're a food bank. We don't want 50 people at once. We're not big enough. We need two on Tuesday, one on Thursday, one on Saturday morning. So we designed a platform underneath whereby, which we're trialing at the moment, we've got 12 lovely brands on there. And you come in and you'll see an exclusive, great offer from the brand. You will not find this anywhere else. This is not a Black Friday thing. So it's really generous, like it might be 50% off pressed juices. It might be VIP access to something. It might be a sample sale invitation. But truly things that basically that you imagine influencers get, which they do. When you click on that brand, it takes you through to a list of activities. And once you choose your activity, which might be helping in a charity shop, working in a food bank, helping a school, doing digital assistance for older people, teaching them how to FaceTime and use their phone or something, you pick what you want to do. And then the calendar pops up and it shows you when the next slots are. So you can go, yeah, I'll take the Friday on morning. Life changes, you have to cancel, you book yourself in for Monday. And when you've done it, so from there, it's hopefully hands-free because the consumer then goes, checks into the cause, does their time. The cause then say to us, yep, Mark came, he was amazing. We verified it. Or they might go, Lauren came, but she was on her phone the whole time. We'd like to come back. So they retain control to make sure it's really good volunteering. But at that point, we also send them a donation because they're doing some admin, you know, but they've got to keep the calendar populated and that type of thing. So the causes are excited because they get donations and they're getting this new type of volunteer. It's no longer, you know, the problem I always found was if you want to, you know, you'd read the paper, you'd see kids aren't getting food at schools, you're heartbroken, you call a food bank, you call it again, you call them six times, they eventually call you back and then they go, you can have Tuesday at 11 for the next 6 months. And no one with a career can do that. It's very, very limiting. So we're using the tech to fill those gaps. It also means that a totally different type of volunteer is coming and meeting them and learning. So the causes are really happy. They're getting some donations and they're getting different people. The brands are happy. They are now giving their discounts to really what matters to them as a company. So Pressed Juices want to support anything that helps everybody get good nutrition. So they really get behind food banks or something. But sometimes we talk to a founder and they say, look, I'm Australian. My parents live over there. I'm in London. And I'm really worried about older people getting lonely. I want us to support people having intergenerational friendships made or something. So it can really be whatever they want. So we plug that all into the system. But because it's a platform, any platform needs volume. You know, we're charging brands a small amount to be on there. So we need investment right now. We're doing our seed round. I'm talking to angels and family offices because we need as many people through the system as possible, as many causes through the system as possible, and as many brands on there as possible. But once, you know, the wireframe is kind of set, we know that system works. We've now just got to blow it up. But my real... So I dream that it'll be global and part of the consumer's experience in general. But there are so many things I think that would be really, really interesting. My favorite one would be if we could work with a video game company. Lots of gamers will not get off the sofa. It's not good for their health. But what if Fortnite or whatever the most popular game is with teenage boys says, you're not getting to the next level until you do 2 hours of food bank. Now, that would be really interesting. One, it's somatic learning. Like you go in there and the first thing you do when you work in a food bank is you're told, you know, there's a poster saying family of five, one can of tuna. The first thing you say is there's a mistake on the poster. There's no way. That's not enough. And they go, yes, you're in a food bank. You know, get on with it. So you're suddenly learning and this empathy that opens up to you seeing it and doing it with your hands. Like that's a really, really important lesson, even if you only do it once. But also, you know, getting people back into social situations, doing things together as a team, it's so good for our health in so many different ways. And I just think if you had brands using their power to just push or nudge a little bit more good behavior, a little bit more empathy, and filling all those holes that these poor causes have, you know, they're desperately using old school WhatsApp groups and things, and it's always the same lovely people who jump in last minute. But what if you could motivate an army of, you know, young men, you go, yeah, come on, we'll fix the school. I'm going to jump two levels on Fortnite because I'm going to go every weekend. Great. And then you get to play a video game all afternoon. I don't care.
And what do you think you learned from setting up Scott Ideas and the evolution of that that's helped you with Earn?
I think probably all the things I'm really not good at. I'm much more comfortable now trusting my skill set and allowing myself to find people that have the opposite skills rather than trying to reach in every single direction and inevitably dropping balls. So I think it's been two very different things because, as I say, you know, now we're taking investment and we have to do an enormously detailed business and financial forecast and all of that stuff. So I'm really, really happy I've had the experience I've had to date, but this has been a lot of new things that I've had to learn really, really quickly. But I think, I honestly think one of the best skills is admitting what you don't know, and that being a completely valid answer. You know, just going like, right, that's a serious hole in our skills or our information or our, you know, whatever it is.
And it is a very different journey, as you say, from, as you described it, following your nose when you set up a PR agency, to the structured planning, the tech build, the finding the companies, the ideas. It's completely different, isn't it, Lauren?
It's really different. And there's one person who, well, Seb, who I mentioned, who said, just go and do it. But there's a wonderful lady called Lavina Lieniger, who's my business partner on Ant. And she was actually a client at One Fine Stay. So we'd worked together before. And I told her about Ant as I was starting it. And she said, this is awesome. You know, tell me that you're ever at a point where you're hiring. And then I think she called a bit later and she said, why hasn't it started? And I sort of, oh, you know, I'm doing this and this. And she said, I know why it's not started, because you don't want to do legals, paperwork, tech. Like, I know the stuff you're really good at, and I know the stuff that I'm really good at. She said, I'll just come into the office and give you a hand. Let's see how it goes. And she came and sat in the office about 6 months. We had no money. She worked so hard, and that was it. I knew I couldn't do it with anyone else. And it's just so great. She's annoyingly creative, actually. Sometimes I have to, you know, have to remind myself that she can't be good at everything, but she actually is good at everything. But yeah, that was a huge turning point, because I would have found that bit almost too onerous to be able to do it.
Well, all I can say, and I'm sure that if you could hear them, all the listeners would say, is many congratulations on what you're doing. I mean, to set up Earn, it's such an amazing idea to make the world a better place, to make everybody a bit happier, to help brands, to help communities, to help individuals. It really is inspiring. So I wish you every success, as I know every listener of this podcast will wish you success. And we look forward to seeing, as the years go by, Earned all over the world, helping communities all over the world be a little bit happier and a little bit better. Thank you for sharing your story, Lauren.
Thank you so much.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.